We have some more exciting news regarding our book, Death by Umbrella, The 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons. Rue Morgue magazine recently said this about the book. What separates Death by Umbrella from your run-of-the-mill glossary is the amount of heart and appreciation within its pages, recommended for gore hounds, list lovers, and trivia fiends. Well, we hope you're one of those and that you pick up the book. It's available at Amazon. Thanks a lot.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right? They're coming! The rats are coming! Thousands of them!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then, something happened.
Oh, good Lord! It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait! There's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
What you have here are fragments of tissue found under the fingernails of one of your companions, barbarously murdered in the middle of the night 1 week ago. Our scientific analysis has traced them to this foulard, which was used to strangle Carol Peterson. If you have ever seen a scarf like this on any person you can identify, it is your duty to report it either to the police or the university authorities. I might add that no one in Perugia, either man or woman, is safe until this killer is captured and brought to justice.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 144, 1973's Torso.
Torso, or if you take the Italian title and translate it, it's The Body Shows Signs of Carnal Violence. That, to me, is a more interesting title.
Yeah.
Although Torso does have certain connotations. This is a movie that I recall when I was first getting into horror, and I would go down to one of the local video shops that had the, you know, the Italian movies, the Giallos, etc. This was one of those movies that was up there, and it had a very interesting looking poster. So I was excited to see it. And I remember renting it, watching it, not being very impressed, and forgetting about it completely.
Yeah.
And then when you suggested doing it for the podcast, and I revisited it, I thought, it's funny, when you revisit a movie, sometimes you realize your initial estimation was too severe, you discover things that weren't there before, or you realize that, you know what, it wasn't good then, it wasn't good now. Mm-hmm. And I think Torso falls into the latter, because it really is an unremarkable giallo.
Yeah, I have a similar experience where you look at the poster and the masked killer is pretty intense, a la Town of the Dreaded Sundown. I like the bow saw, which is like a C-shaped saw that the killer brandishes but doesn't really use too much. He mm-hmm. mostly wields a knife or a scarf in typical giallo fashion. But I thought, oh, this is gonna be awesome, and he's got a mask, he's got this crazy saw, this is gonna be sinister, it's gonna be amazing. But as they say in Italian, tutto fumo e niente arrosto, a lot of smoke, no sizzle, well, the equivalent, yeah, no roast. So like, it's a stylish movie but has no cohesive scares or plot. It looks lovely and it's like a travelogue for central Italy, but that's it. Like, I was just admiring the city of Perugia and going, geez, I'd love to go there.
I thought, compared to the master of the genre of giallos, you know, especially your Argentos and your Babas.
Oh, it doesn't hold
this
up as well.
Black style completely.
Oh, okay. Well, compared to the maestros of those.
You know, this movie was directed by Sergio Martino, who is most famous for directing Mountain of the Cannibal Gods.
Oh, I thought you were going to mention like one of my all-time favorite titles. I'm going to get it wrong, but it's my vice is the key that unlocks your whatever. What is that one?
Your vice is a locked room and only I have the key.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the greatest title ever. Yeah. And he's lensing this one, longtime Giallo Polizzi-Teschi director. Got a lot of pedigree doing this kind of thing, but
you know, I mean, like you said, he directed Mountain of the Cannibal God. I mean, that was one of the movies that kickstarted the whole Italian cannibal genre that predated, I believe, Cannibal Ferox and Cannibal Holocaust. It actually had name actors in it. Okay. Stacy Keach, Ursula Andress. But it was a pretty fucking vile movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a movie that climaxed with pig fucking. He directed the equally
you
unremarkable...
say that so matter-of-factly, yeah.
And, you know, when you see as many horror movies as I have, it's nothing shocks me. Hey, he's fucking a pig. Okay, whatever, you know? He followed that up with the unremarkable Island of the Fishman, which I talked about in A Crap of the Week. That was sort of like a riff on Island of Dr. Moreau. He did, you know, at one point the Italians decided to move into the whole post-apocalyptic genre, ripping those off after the success of Mad Max. He directed 2019 after the fall of New York. All these movies are okay, but nobody puts Sergio Martino on the pantheon of great Italian filmmakers, horror filmmakers. Not, I wouldn't even say he's on the A-list nor the B-list. If anything, he's on the C-list. He's down there with your Lamberto Bavas, your...
Lenzies? No, okay, he's more a B, yeah.
Lenzies, yeah. You know, where would we even put Bruno Mattei? I don't know. But, yeah, so, I mean, Martino is not exactly a filmmaker that you can count on for art, craft, composition. What you can count on Martino for is exploitative goods. And Torso brings the exploitative goods, which ways makes it an almost atypical giallo. Because the thing about the giallo, and you know, we've talked about the giallo many, many times, the word giallo in Italian, of course, means yellow. And
it was all giallo. I'm singing my Coldplay there. But yeah, like from
we
the Paul
giallo submarine.
Yeah. And then based obviously on the post-war, post-Mussolini fiction novels that would have a yellow cover typically in a revolver.
Yeah, they were these Darmster novels, they were crime novels, they were murder mysteries. They'd be sold for, let's say, a dime at the newsstand. They were consumed like cotton candy. I don't know where that analogy came from. So many much cotton candy. Yeah. And so when these murder mysteries started being made, they gave them the term giallos because they were reminiscent of those dime store novels. Mm-hmm. But this is atypical because giallos, for one thing, the best ones, and I'm talking about, you know, the animal trilogy that Argento did, a lot of them animals in the title, A Lizard in a Woman's Skin by Lucio Fulci, Bava's Blood and Black Lace, what have you, they had style to spare, but they're also restrained. This one was not restrained. This is lurid. It's got a ton of nudity. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it sort of, you know, I mean, it sort of took away from the stylistic...
Yeah, pretense and stuff. Mm-hmm. And speaking of pretense, right at the beginning, we get Sergio Martini aspiring for something greater by showing us the artworks on display in the city of Perugia, which is outside of Rome, where he's from. And you get this ridiculous scene where this pompous professor is sounding off about the wonders of 15th century Renaissance painter Perugino and talking about Saint Sebastian. And he's talking, like trying to impress one of his undergrads with his worldly knowledge of art, and they're wandering through the gallery, and you're just, really, the city of Perugia is the star. I was just so mesmerized by just looking at the city.
Well,
and going,
because
I just want to walk around the piazza. I don't care about these people getting murdered. Like,
I'm watching this movie, and well, it actually starts off with a killing. Mm-hmm. And then it goes into this class. And it's some sort of like art history appreciation class. And you have the professor standing there in front of his slideshow. And all the students looking at him with this rapt admiration.
Yeah. Like your students do with you.
And it's a complete antithesis of my experience where I'm standing there in front of my bloody PowerPoint. And my students cannot look more bored. They got a glazed look in their eyes. And then, of course, when the lecture is over, they haven't had enough. And... Mm-hmm. it's, you see this a lot in movies where they're walking across the campus and they're like the Pied Piper, and the students follow them. Professor, when you talked about the use of chiaroscuro and blah 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 blah, what did you mean? And they have this lively academic debate. Whereas with me, it's like when I say, "Okay, guys, class is over." They can't get out of there fast enough.
And an experience from our own undergraduate experience. Couldn't wait to just get the hell out and go to the library, go to the, get some,
go to the bar, chow or whatever. Campus,
or the campus bar, as the case may be,
And this is Professor Franz, and he's got some young students. Carol is one. Another one is Jane. Jane is an American, and Jane has, you know, she fancies her professor. And that is sort of reciprocated.
Yeah, so we get this lengthy discussion about the Saint Sebastian and how it's, this painting is about an indifference to suffering, which is, might be like the tagline for all of horror movies, really. So maybe that's what they're trying to aspire to do by showing this piece of art, suffering indifference. I don't know, that's my takeaway. Maybe I didn't pay enough attention during the lecture myself, and I was taking notes for this, but who knows. This is set against the backdrop of, again, Perugia, which has a school. We get a little taste of what students get up to on their downtime. In our case, it was drinking excessive amounts of beer. There's two students here who pair up, and under cover of night in his car, they do the equivalent of make-out point in Italy, which is just, I don't know, driving somewhere secluded, and he starts stooping her right there, and again, gobs of nudity. The opening credits has tons of nudity. Anyway, they think that they're being spied on. The man jumps off and decides to go into the dark to see what is the matter.
Leave the girl all alone. And so the guy goes off, I mean, to see, you know, who might be peeping on
lurking,
them, leaving the girl alone. And of course, I mean, here the mainstay of Giallo's black glove killer. We see a man wearing a black glove. Instead of wearing, let's say, a trench coat and a fedora, he's wearing a white ski mask. And he then strangles her with a scarf. And which is, you know, I guess, you know, somewhat Giallo-esque. But then he goes further and he slices into her torso. And it's here where we see that, you know, this movie is going to go for the gusto when it comes to gore. And yet again, that's fairly atypical. Most Giallos don't do that. I mean, they're fairly restrained. You get the stab, you get the killing, but they don't really go into the anatomical aspect of it all. But here in torso, I mean, I guess because you're using an anatomical part of the body as the title of your movie, you're going to get into this.
Oh, and speaking of cuts, there's, in several instances, there's quick cutaways to dolls, which will factor into this movie as well.
Yeah, and that's where, wonderful.
It's silly, but there's quick cuts interspersed to these dolls with their eyes open, and the killer flashes back to inserting his fingers into the doll's eye holes, and then it cuts back to his cutting and his opening of the women's blouses to expose their breasts after he does the slice. So yeah, the doll business that has reared its ugly head going on now 40 years in the horror space guises.
If you, one of the great shells of all time, Dario Argento's Deep Red, I mean, the doll motif was huge in that one. In horror movies, we now know, as you said before, for 40 years, dolls equal either psychopathy, depending upon who has the doll, or creepiness. Maybe the doll even is the killer itself, or I don't know, but Child's Play, Annabelle, what have you. But in Deep Red, it was a giallo that used a doll to very creepy effect, and this is just Martino ripping off Dario Argento.
For sure. And not in as profundo a way either. So, yeah, again, you have this thing going on, and in the town, obviously, it's a liberal city with all these, a bunch of college students there, but it's also in the height of, or maybe the tail end of, the hippie era. So you have these hippie communes, which is ridiculous too, and they...
Well, it was more like a happening. It was a hip happening party.
More of a cult, really.
We had a bunch of kids there, and they were making love, and smoking dope, and dancing. Yeah. And, yeah, there's this one woman, and she's topless, and she's dancing to some generic music. And I, the camera, this is the artist Martino, is, like, pointed, literally, right up her skirt.
Yeah.
And we get this wonderful shot of her, of an upskirt.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I remember when cell phones were first, coming to prominence, that was something that's quite controversial. People...
Yes. And high profile upskirt shots too, of your Paris Hilton getting out of the limo and whatnot. Yeah, that, not in any way particularly artistic there.
No. But he's bringing the lure goods. We got the gore, we got the nudity, we got the leering camera shots and angles.
but really that's all just ingredients for the cake that's going to be baked later, which is your standard bunch of women trapped in a house getting picked off one by one. So it's interesting that you would conjure up all this atmosphere, which really has nothing in the way of advancing a plot. You set this in a school, and you think, okay, the student body is going to be terrorized by this killer. And they do make an announcement about be on the lookout for this particular scarf, because that's part of the MO, but it really just ups and transplants to a villa for no reason. Like, you have this movie does not know where it's going and leads you down, I guess, a garden path, but then of something potentially procedural and interesting, and then leaves it in the hands of your standard Black Christmas, girls in a house, guy walking around, POV killing.
But before we get to the villa, you got the other thing that you always have is, you know, more red herrings than in your local fish market.
Yeah.
And this one is the same. I mean,
yeah, then the best one being obviously the scarf monger, or if you will,
Poulard monger. That was the thing.
Is that what it was? I was trying to spell it in Google with like culot, Kular, Kumar. Like, I was putting all these variants in with C's and K's, so it's Poulard.
I believe so. Yeah. I mean, wow. I believe that in perhaps French. I don't know.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah.
Poulard is scarf. So at one point, the inspector, and that's another thing this film lacks.
Good usually, police work.
Exactly. That's another thing that Hallmark of Giallo. The focus is on the killer and the police. So they're procedurals. There's a lot of procedural elements. This one, there's very little of that. We have the inspector in the class going, the killer used this Poulard. If you see anyone wearing this Poulard, let us know right away.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to think it's a mass-produced Poulard, right? So, and the other thing
while we're questioning police work. Okay. Oh, damn it. Oh, okay, you'll get back to your point. Just because, like, one woman is killed, like, does that mean that we can be guaranteed that this guy's hunting the student body of this university rather than, let's say, randomly killing women in the city? Because that it seems immaterial that the victim happens to be a college student, but she wasn't on campus. She was just killed in the city of Perugia. So why they made this big to-do about marching into a lecture hall and saying, have you seen this scar from presenting it? It's like, this is totally absurd.
And then the other thing,
why don't they go to every public building in the whole town, man, and like present that? Do you know it? Do you know this?
Well, and that's the other thing, too. And that's the other cliche that you see in many police procedurals, not just in the horror space, but detective, humanities, what have you, where they have some sort of incriminating piece of evidence. And they go to the shop, and in this case, they go to the Poulard vendor.
Do you remember this?
Do you remember?
Who bought this?
Yeah. And to this movie's credit...
Yeah, I love that bit. Yeah.
The creepy guy goes, I see people every day. I see thousands of people walking by. I'm going to remember who bought a particular Poulard, a particular scarf. And it's so true. I mean, there was a time in my life when I worked at... I mean, I worked many retail jobs, and I would see customers come in, come out, whatever. And let's say I was working at... There was a time I was working at Sam the Record Man, which was a pretty big local record store here in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And earlier on, you referenced Coldplay. If some guy walked into the store and bought Coldplay parachutes and then decided to use that to bludgeon someone to death, and then someone came back, a police officer came in, let's say a week later, and said, do you recall selling this Coldplay parachute to someone? I'd be like, well, I've sold about 100 of these right now, and... Oh, but wait a second. There was it's unfathomable that you would remember. You know, this is such a rare item of value or antiquity or whatever. It doesn't make logical sense, and yet it's done over and over and over again.
At the risk of incriminating yourself, then would you happen to be able to remember your students' names? Or does it just, like in a semester, does it all disappear?
Oh, man, why are you asking this question? Honestly.
Okay, you're going to plead the fifth.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. You remember them 10 years hence, for sure. And then they come to you saying, Professor Kirshner, you are such an unbelievable role model and inspiration to me. But anyway.
Sometimes I don't even remember their faces. They come up to me a semester later, hello, Professor. I'm like, it takes me a second or two to register them. I mean, then I don't recall which particular class I taught them in. But that's immaterial. Let's get back to this. Because, so we have this, as I mentioned earlier, this girl, Jane, and her professor, Franz, the art professor, they have sort of a courtship going on, and he invites her to a opera, I believe.
Mm-hmm. A romantic fellow there, because he actually etches it into the dust on her windshield and says, I have two biglietti or whatever, two tickets to this symphony or whatever it is. He writes it. And
he also writes, it's a good thing you never wash your car.
How
bloody convenient. Did he have a plan B? Wash your car? Would he have a bar of soap or something? Anyhow.
Yeah, hilarious.
But ultimately, other people are getting killed, other girls are getting killed, and they're all getting killed by the same MO. So Jane's uncle suggests that because Jane is alternately, I guess, afraid and shaken up, that her and her friends go to this villa.
Yeah, and get away from it all mm-hmm. and try and get their heads together and just mm-hmm. go on ostensibly to relax outside and the city.
Wouldn't you know it? The killer falls in there. The red herrings fall in there. This is another thing, you know, this guy's got to be the killer. Oh, shit, he just got killed by the killer?
Yeah, yeah.
He must not be the killer. Mm. And on and on. It's your standard giallo. And, you know, we're not going to say who the killer is or was, but were you surprised?
I can't really say, honestly, because I was starting to really drift off things.
Oh, like, yeah, because there's a long, boring stretch, because the killer ultimately, Jane goes up there with four of her friends, and the killer offs them all, except for Jane. And she's stuck there in the villa with the killer lurking inside, outside, mutilating these corpses, dragging them to God knows where,
yeah.
for God knows what reason, and it just keeps, this goes for at least 20, 30 minutes of the fun. It's internally boring.
True, but thankfully, as you mentioned, this being a little excessive when it comes to both nudity and gore, we have amazing and unnecessary set pieces of these college women at this stunning hilltop villa retreat, which is just palatial. It looks like it was probably owned by some duke of some sort. And they're out there. Not only are the women continually nude sunbathing, there's a really, really evocative lesbian scene between the African-American student and one of the girls up there, too. And they have a really, like, kind of lurid peeping Tom camera that sort of focuses in on them as the black woman gradually undresses her friend there, and it's just totally unnecessary. For 20 minutes, they're just all there strip-teasing and dancing and just, yeah, unbelievable. And then even to compound that, they had a delivery man coming in from town. I think his name was Gianni. Delivers them vegetables with a cart, like a push cart, and he, of course, happens upon them in all states of undress. And he's buddies with guys in the town who are really horny, and he tells them about this incredible scene he had, and they, of course, don't believe him and say, no, you're just talking out of your ass. Yeah, there weren't three naked girls there. There was 1,000. If you're going to make it up, why not make up more? And yeah, it's just ridiculous. Constant stream of nudity, lesbianism, just strip teases. And that really, like, I guess to its credit, because otherwise, yeah, we were both nodding off, but that was the occasional little bit of salaciousness to keep you somewhat interested.
Well, you know what? It's funny, because earlier I did say that this movie lacks style. Now, and we talked about this, you know, hippie hangout happening where kids are smoking dope and dancing.
Playing guitar and all
right.
that, yeah.
That actually presaged what is probably the most celebrated scene in this movie. Because there is a girl by the name of Carol, and she's taken there by her boyfriend. And after smoking a bit of dope, he wants to get a little frisky with her. She doesn't feel comfortable. She leaves this warehouse or whatever space it was, and she runs out into the streets, and she notices someone behind her. She hears something, and she realizes that she's being stalked by the killer. And she's in an urban environment. And then she's running.
Oh, and then she appears in a birch forest.
All
in the
of
middle
sudden,
of, yeah.
She's in the forest from the Neverending Story.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And it looks good.
Yeah.
It's a good-looking scene. It's composed well. It's shot well.
Mm.
The use of lighting is good. You know, she falls into the mud, etc., etc. There's a kill there and everything. That's a stylish scene. That's a good-looking scene.
Yeah, she's forced into the mud and then murdered right there. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah, a lovely scene.
But it's improbable how all of a sudden she
yeah.
goes from, you know, the urban streets of, what's the city?
Yeah, Perugia.
Perugia.
Yeah.
To,
yeah, just some weird forest
some
with
forest
no context.
Some fantasy
yeah.
movie. But that is probably the most famous.
That's the showstopper,
yeah.
Yeah.
So, between that, the use of the hacksaw, the mask of the visage of the killer, this movie has achieved some degree of notoriety, some degree of appreciation. It's just, but ultimately, I don't think it really delivers the goods. When they reveal the killer, it's completely obvious. The motive is completely obvious. I don't want to say who the killer is.
No, but they did shoehorn in his backstory in an utterly insane, ridiculous manner. And yeah, again, with all the women trapped in this palatial, sprawling villa, they add a little bit of tension by virtue of, I guess, the silence, because this movie is so replete with awful, like, hotel lobby tinkling piano music and just, like, AM radio background tinkling that the one scene that was particularly evocative was just the steps of the killer. And when he stalks the final girl in the bedroom of this house and he's toying with her. That was the only time this really came alive because it was silent. And it was quite a good use of POV as well, but it was really a stretch of 15 minutes where this is compelling. Mm. And the rest of the time, you're just indifferent.
And you mentioned the soundtrack as well. Some of the greatest giallos are known for extremely evocative scores by the likes of Ennio Morricone or other noted composers of, you know, Italian cinema. This one, it's a very unremarkable score. So, ultimately, I would say this movie, it doesn't succeed. I mean, I think maybe a star rating, and then what did we learn?
Okay, sure.
Okay, so star rating for me, 2 stars.
Yeah, I guess if it came out later, then the star rating would decrease, but some people have cited this influence on subsequent slasher films.
Such as?
The type of film, or the reviewers?
No, the actual movies, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, just any of your standard films where people are trapped in a house, which is really not that big, like Slumber Party Massacre or Black Christmas something.
That was Night of the Living Dead when they were trapped in a house.
Yeah, yeah, true enough, I guess. Well, yeah, I guess you could call Night of the Living Dead a proto-slasher, too.
I wouldn't call it that for a second. But.
Well, but it was, you know, reproduced in Assault on Precinct 13, where you have a bunch of people trying to fend for themselves.
Slasher.
Well, that was a zombie movie. Dressed up as an action movie, but who knows?
That was a Western movie.
If you're gonna say that, then it's also like we always talk about with, like, just because something's influential doesn't make it good.
Uh-huh.
We always turn to, let's say, Grandmaster Flash, and say, okay, good on you for being in 1976 and coming out with some kind of good music, but really you would not listen to Grandmaster Flash when you have the opportunity to listen to Redman or Biggie. Like, you know what I mean? So, and I would say 2.75 for this, maybe 2.5, because if it came out in the 80s, it would just be just forgettable. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it came out in 72, before all this stuff became a tired retread. But even that, like, that's really grasping at straws, because as you said, this is derivative itself. So while parts of it were influential to others, it's still a knockoff of other things, and not even as good of the type of giallo films that you were talking about earlier. So, yeah, a reluctant 2.5. What did we learn?
Well, another lazy trope, and you see this a lot in movies, whether it being the urban and rural divide, you know, and in Italy, this is, you know, it's like sort of like the city country where in the cities they're all a bunch of urban sophisticates wearing poulards, whereas in the villages and the country they're all a bunch of uneducated rubes.
This
movie plays right into that, because do you recall the name of the village where they went to?
No.
It was a small town somewhere in the country, and everybody there, whether it's the milk seller or Belloc, the shoe salesman, you know, everybody is just a rube. I don't want to say the word, let's just say they're special. And it's another lazy trope that we see in movies many times, where urban sophisticate, country
bumpkin superstitious
idiot.
Hick,
And so, you know, so between that, between the use of the doll, which was perfunctory and had no real...
No resonance. It was tacked on at the end. It was introduced at the beginning. You look at it and go, oh, what's that doll? And then it's tied together in a loose bouquet at the end and just go, yeah.
Jane, don't look at me like that. I had to do it. I had to, Jane. I had to. They were only dolls, stupid dolls made out of flesh and blood. But you're not like the others. You're different, Jane. You're pure.
So this movie was sort of like a collection of giallo cliches with a little bit of extra heaping of sleaze and exploitation to make it a bit more, I guess that's why it is a little more admired than it should be. So is that what I learned? Kind of, yeah.
Well, I guess I learned a little bit more about the wonders of this local painter who, like, I guess, was just shamelessly inserted there to celebrate the city of Perugia. And really, this is a travel log. That's about it. You could see this maybe on the Discovery Channel or the Travel Channel of the place you can go to
enjoy. But you wouldn't see as many boobies.
No, no. So yeah, but this is just... because it's kind of a forgotten city in Italy when you look at the likes of Ponte Vecchio in Florence and the exciting treasures to behold in Rome and Naples. It's just like Perugia. Well, maybe they could have capitalized on this. Like, I really want to go to Perugia right now. Do I want to see this movie again or other works by Sergio Martino? No, but take me to Perugia.
Just make sure if you're booking your plane ticket to Perugia that you enunciate it, otherwise you might be on a plane to Fallujah.
But... Yeah, true enough. And I don't think there are any direct flights to Perugia, but anyway...
Or Fallujah.
No, yeah, true enough. And
I don't think Fallujah Air is doing improving business anytime.
Oh, and we gotta say, what I learned here was, my God, if you're gonna go out of your way to at least attempt to do something stylish and have this hilltop villa and all this, the wonders and riches and splendor of Renaissance art, there's a flashback to a childhood trauma. And we're not gonna say more for those who haven't seen it, but the fakest body hurtling down the side of a cliff ever that I've seen in any movie. This is up there with anything we would have seen on any sketch comedy show, whether it be your SCTV or SNL. This body just hurtling toward Earth at a 45-degree angle, looking just unbelievably fake. And I thought, why? Why do this? They could have even hinted at this and not sent them over the precipice. It is the terrible flaw that is worth probably half a star just for that. It's just brutal.
So, yeah, I mean, another thing I learned from this movie is, it's not just from the movie, but from going to Europe a couple times, they do love their scarves. The moment, yes, the second that there's just a little bit of a nip in the air, all of a sudden the poulards come out. So
I was thinking the same thing with Toronto. As soon as the Humidex dips to a bone-chilling 29 degrees centigrade, then the jackets come out. It's like, what the fuck, you know? Like, oh God, it starts the day at 20. Oh, I'm catching a chill on the subway. Get my jacket. Like, my God. We're sweating like pigs today, but anyway, yeah, it's ridiculous.
Yeah,
the scarves are so ubiquitous, especially among hipsters.
It's a white person.
It's so crazy. Right? Yeah, I mean, it really is.
I've never been much of a scarf wearer,
no.
But I this movie inspired me because, I mean, just the fact that I now know that it's also referred to as a poulard. There's something so sophisticated about that that I think I might start rocking the poulard. I don't know. You think that would be a good look for me?
Why not?
It's either the poulard or the ascot. What do you
think? I was going to say the ascot. It's a real dandy look.
Yeah. It might be a dickie.
Yeah. Always go with the dickie. Okay. I've often thought like rocking the seersucker suit, but I just think I'm just too far north of the Mason-Dixon line to really pull that off. And check out our equally stylish website with reviews updated 2 to 3 times a week. www.reallyawfulmovies.com and follow us on Twitter, awful_movies, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.